Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? I've just come upstairs. I'm sitting here in my my office. I've just watched Arsenal versus Cologne. Cologne versus Arsenal, I should say, in the Europa League. I'm sitting here now. Got a glass of wine. And, you know, usually when you play a European game, that, you know, it plays a big part in your podcast because, you know, the matches are what everything is about. That's why we're here. The football. We talk about it. We preview it. We review it. We relive it. And I'm sitting here going, I don't want to. I don't want to talk about that game. Not because I'm particularly annoyed or anything. It was just shite. It was bad. Bad, bad, bad. We played poorly. I mean, they're a terrible team. Let's be honest about it. Let's not beat around the bush here. Let's not say that, you know, we were beaten on the night by a better team who had some dynamic attacking players with lots of verve and spunk. But that's not the case. That's not what we did. We lost to a team who are terrible, who didn't play particularly well. I mean, this is their record from the start of the season, okay? They won their first game, then they lost, they lost, they lost, they lost, they lost, they lost again, then they drew a game, then they had four defeats in a row, they drew another game, then they won, hallelujah, they lost again, then they won, they beat Bate Borisov 5-2 in the Europa League a few weeks back, then they lost their next two games, and, you know, really they're rubbish, but we out-rubbished them on the night. It was not a good performance, not a good display. There were some, like, individuals who didn't do too badly. I mean, defensively, we didn't have an awful lot to do. I thought Mertesacker was quite good. What else? Ainsley Maitland-Niles had some good moments down the left, but really, you know, needs to work on his final ball. But that was kind of it, you know? Jack Wilshere, Olivier Giroud, Mohamed Elneny, Francis Coquelin. These guys who, as Arsene Wenger said before the game, are determined to show what they're about so they can force themselves into his thinking for the first team, for the Premier League. None of them did that. None of them did that. None of them even came close to doing that. All the talk, for example, of Jack Wilshere being brought back into the team, it's like, oh, well, he hasn't really done anything to suggest that he would make things any better. And I get the counter-argument of that, which could be that if you put Jack in a team with better players around him, he might find it easier. But, you know, we're not playing particularly good teams here. Wilshere and Giroud, you know, these are experienced international players who you would expect to maybe give a bit more and maybe produce a bit more to make up for some of the slack. So, you know, it was really not a good performance. But we'll have to talk a little bit about the game with someone who was there. We might keep it fairly brief, though, because really, nobody's got much time to relive that. A little bit later on, I will be chatting to Daniel Story from Football 365 about teacup stuff, the media, the journalists, writers, reactions, fans, tribalism, the modern media landscape. It's an interesting chat, so we've got that to look forward to a bit later on. As well as that, I'll give you the winners of the Jens Lehmann competition. Last week, I gave you a chance to win one of five copies of Jens Lehmann's autobiography, The Madness is on the Pitch. There was no madness on the pitch tonight, I can tell you, apart from, no, there was no madness. No madness whatsoever. That would have been quite good if there'd been some madness. I mean, I did enjoy Francis Coquelin kicking the ball out of play directly, just dribbling the ball out. That was good. I also enjoyed him nearly scoring. Wow, what was going on there? He had one shot which went just wide, and then he hit the post, and you're thinking, what the fuck is happening in the world? Are all the planets aligned? Is this the night that Francis Coquelin finally gets his first goal for Arsenal? No. It's not. It's not that night. We know it's not that night. But look, to talk a little bit more about the game, sorry, but this is why we're here. I'm joined from Cologne by a man who was there witnessing that incredible spectacle, Archie Rin Tutt. Archie, has the heartbeat settled down yet?
To be fair, the atmosphere at the end was memorable. I wouldn't say that the game was particularly in any reach of it. I was looking around the press box and I just saw a lot of eyes rolling throughout the game because I don't think they could believe quite how bad Cologne were. They'd seen that they were obviously bottom of the Bundesliga, but I don't think that that's a game that will live long in the memory of Cologne fans, to be honest, as a game, but I think the result certainly will.
Yeah, I mean, it gives them a chance, doesn't it, in the final round to qualify. The other game finished in a draw. So in all, a really good night for Cologne. Like you say, I don't think they're gonna relive that 90 minutes often, but certainly the result will be a positive thing for them.
I think they'll struggle to shift DVDs, but if they were maybe to consolidate it down to the 10 seconds of the ball going in and the full-time whistle, then they might shift a bit more. But no, if you're looking at things from a Cologne perspective, they are so shot for confidence. I think any Arsenal fan would have recognised that tonight, given the performance they gave in the first half and, to be honest, the long periods of the second half as well. So they really needed that, especially because they've got a big game in the Bundesliga on Sunday they've made the worst start of any Bundesliga side to a season in 40 years. I would say that they very much look like that tonight, just in terms of the lack of tempo and the hesitancy that is present in their game at present. But the coach, Peter Sturger, he's under a lot of pressure. He was on the front page, or he's been on the front page of the local tabloid Express pretty much every day this week. And they put him next to Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, saying, can they do it, in reference to whether they can both turn around their current beleaguered situations. I'm not sure who's got a better chance of doing that at present, because 2 points in 12 games is not a very good record indeed.
No, well, you know, if Angela Merkel needs a shot in the arm, she should arrange a fixer against Arsenal, because we are absolute experts at providing teams with exactly that. I mean, the Arsenal performance, like you say, Cologne are absolutely shot for confidence. They've only won three times all season. There was such a hesitancy about Arsenal, wasn't there, that they didn't really step out of, I hesitate to say, second gear, because I don't think they really got out of first gear. They sort of sauntered through the game. There wasn't much dynamism in the way that they played. And certainly in the final third, there was no service for Olivier Giroud, who didn't look like he wanted to get on the end of anything anyway.
I thought the home side's lack of hesitancy almost overshadowed it, because I thought Arsenal were the team who were looking far more likely to score. I would have said if you played this game in 8 out of 10 circumstances, you would probably get an away win. Mm. And I think that actually in the first half, I didn't think Arsenal looked necessarily good, but I would say decent enough and would have been good value to be ahead. And I would say they were probably good enough value to win the game, such was the amount of chances they created. They just came up against a very inspired goalkeeper in Timo Horn, who was certainly, I think, relishing the chance to try and show himself in terms of against a big club. But I thought that when Alex Iwobi came on, they looked a little bit more dynamic. But I think the fact that Arsenal already had the group all sewn up pretty much. I know that the group win was confirmed tonight, and I'm sure they'll be celebrating into the early hours in North London. I wouldn't say it was all that bad a display from Arsenal. I thought that, yeah, Giroud certainly did struggle for service in the middle, but I thought Jack Wilshere actually looked quite good tonight as well. I thought that he was keeping the ball, and actually when he got in positions around the box, I thought he always looked like making something happen. But maybe that doesn't say too much when you're playing against this current Cologne side.
No, maybe not. I mean, I think you're being fairly generous. I take your point about the first half. Certainly there were moments for Arsenal and moments where they looked dangerous, but perhaps it says a lot about the way that the team played tonight, where the most dangerous moments came from Francis Coquelin, a man who is not renowned for his goal scoring. I think the last time he scored a goal in professional football was when he was on loan at Freiburg some years ago, and he was the one who came closest for Arsenal tonight.
He was. That post hit in the first half, I thought, was going to be the harbinger of sort of something a little bit more for Arsenal. But I thought even he looked a little bit nervous in terms of the way that he was going about his business. Mm. There were two moments in the first half when he just ran the ball harmlessly out of play. And I think that lack of control, I think it generally started to infect the Arsenal side a little bit more, even after Cologne had scored in the second half. But yeah, I thought that Coquelin was pretty much mostly a passenger in the game, I would say.
Mm. The goal that won the game for Cologne, I think, is pretty dubious. I mean, he put the penalty away very well, but it was one, to me, it looked like an absolute dive in the box. What were your thoughts on that?
I'm going to have to sound a little bit like a manager here, because I've not seen a replay just yet. but everything I've been reading is that it's been a dubious penalty. The Cologne fans would say back to you that they had an equally dubious penalty go against them at the weekend. But it didn't get overturned by VAR or video evidence. So it's perhaps ironic that actually without VAR, they got the penalty awarded. And to be honest, the speed it happened at, I can understand why the referee would have given it. But I think, yeah, I haven't seen the replay myself, but I can well believe that.
Yeah,
it looked, the way he went down, it was quite soft all the same.
Mm.
I think Cologne probably deserve a little bit of luck, given the way that things have been going for them in the league. That's all I can attest to that.
Right, fair enough. Arsenal have conceded too many penalties. We keep conceding penalties, and I think it's a bit of an issue. Certainly, people point to the fact that Petr Cech doesn't save them. David Ospina didn't save it tonight. And the bigger issue, of course, is giving away penalties. Just very finally, do you think, Arsene Wenger will come away from this? I mean, he's obviously not going to be happy about losing the game, but the result between Bate Borisov and Red Star Belgrade means that Arsenal win the group, which I suppose is the aim when you begin a competition like this. It may give him a chance to experiment a little in the final game, perhaps play a few more of the youngsters. He seemed to put out an experienced side tonight because he wanted to make sure that the job got done. It might be time just to say, okay, I know what some of these experienced players can do. Let's give some youth a chance.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, particularly because I think that the only thing that he will have learned tonight really would have been more negatives than positives about his players. I think when the way that Rob Holding was turned by John Cordoba of Cologne, a man who has been very much struggling for confidence and was whistled off the pitch by the home fans in the second half, I don't think that speaks too highly of his performance. I didn't quite understand why Callum Chambers was being played at wing-back instead of Debuchy. I think it's perhaps a statement of what Arsene Wenger thinks in terms of the pace that Matthew Debuchy has, or the lack of it. But I thought that Debuchy would have probably been a more comfortable pick at wing-back, for example.
Mm.
But I think that otherwise, I think he saw once again the impact and the drive that Alex Iwobi can bring, for sure. But I think that some of those young players who are coming off the bench, the likes of Reece Nelson, Eddie Nketiah, I can't pronounce his name, I don't think you said if that's correct. You
got it spot on.
But I think it'll be good. Okay. But I think they'll probably be relishing a chance in that final home game, just to have another kind of chance to try and show what they're about. But I would say a very forgettable night for Arsenal, but I don't think they'll put too much of an emphasis on the result tonight. I think you saw that in terms of the way that the supporters reacted when the Arsenal players went over to the fans immediately at the end of the game. All the Arsenal fans were applauding. I think they were understanding of the circumstances. So I don't think that any Arsenal fan is going to have real trouble processing this result, that's for sure.
I might wager that most of the Arsenal fans in that away end are pissed up on gigantic German beers, so that might help. But
we're not in Cologne, Andrew.
Oh, no?
Not in Cologne, Andrew. You're meant to get them small here in Cologne.
Oh, right.
They come in 0.2s generally.
Oh, wow.
So, but I'm sure I would wager that a lot of the Arsenal fans will manage to get through quite a lot tonight. All the same, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
and I think after the result, I'm sure the home fans will be offering them to them for free as well. So they might not do too badly.
Yeah, it could be a good evening in Cologne. All right, well, Archie, thanks very much indeed. I'll let you go and get one of those relatively small beers to calm yourself down. Thanks as ever. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew. Cheers.
Thank you very much indeed to Archie. You can follow him on Twitter at @ArchieRT1. That is at @ArchieRT1. So there you go. One more game to go in the Europa League. It's Bate Borisov at home. And here's what I would like to see happen. I would like all the kids to play. I would like Arsene Wenger to say, fuck it. We've won the group. I know what these guys can do. I know what Giroud, Elneny, Coquelin, Wilshere, I know what these guys can do. I've seen it time and time again. Let's go all in with a really young team. Give these kids a chance. Play them in front of the home fans. It's probably not going to be the record Emirates attendance, I wouldn't imagine, for this particular game. They should do something with the tickets, actually. Just give them away, or fiver to like schools and stuff, and just pack the place full of young Arsenal fans. Play a really young team who are enthusiastic and you know, are up for it. This is a chance for them to really show that they can do something. And who knows? It could be just a fun night. You know, the result doesn't mean anything. It's not going to like derail our momentum or anything like that. So just like go for it. Play the kids. Have a crack. See what happens. You know, I'd much rather that than see some of those guys out there again just kind of going through the motions or doing what they do when we know that that's what they do. And they haven't over the course of this Europa League campaign, some of these senior players, put any pressure on the manager to select them for the first team. They just haven't. So, you know, why should they get another go? We've had five games. Let's see some kids out there and have a bit of crack with it. That's what I think. Anyway, probably won't happen, but I'd like to see that happen. Right. The competition from last week, I gave you a chance to win one of five copies of Jens Lehmann's autobiography, The Madness is on the Pitch. The random number generator has done its thing. The winners are Ron Nord, Darren Hemmett, Keith Miller, Niall Doherty, and Mark Renshaw. Congratulations to you guys. I think I have all your details. I'll just double check that I have them. The publisher will send the book out to you. And for the rest of you, if you want to pick that book up, it's quite interesting and entertaining. It's quite oddly written. I can't explain whether it's to do with the translation from German or whether it's just the way that Jens expresses himself, but there are just bits when you're reading it, you go, that's a really odd phrase. That's a really strange way of putting that. But then I don't suppose you would expect anything less from Jens Lehmann anyway. So there you go. Congratulations to you guys. The books will be on the way soon. God. 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 What a wonderful cup. What a wonderful cup. God. Such great memories. God. 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 Enjoy the moment. Enjoy the occasion. I will be there. Make it a spectacular game. Keep on going to the last second. That's what it's all about. God. 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 I wish I was God. 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 God.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back. Now, much has happened since the last time we spoke on this particular podcast. Arsenal beat Tottenham 2-0 at the Emirates last weekend. Very enjoyable, very fun altogether. They got put back in their box a little bit, didn't they? They were taken out of their box, and now they're sort of put back in it. You know, the box, the one that's sort of there in the corner, it's marked "You'll Always Be Shit." You know that box. The one that they've existed in for many years. And of course, there was a lot of furore online because of what the Arsenal Twitter account did. Very sinister behavior on their part, posting a picture of Mesut Ozil drinking a cup of tea at one particular journalist. But, you know, jokes aside, it did lead to some unacceptable behavior from a very small number, I think it should be fair to say, but still an unacceptable number of Arsenal fans who leveled abuse at the journalist who did that, you know, combined 11 and picked all the Spurs players thing, you know. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because where does the responsibility lie? Is it with Arsenal, or is it with the people who make those comments? Is it with Twitter? Where is the responsibility? Should accounts with big followings know better than to be a bit mischievous online? Or do we then rob ourselves of something if, because of the actions of a few idiots, you know, accounts with big followings can't post things like that? You know, it's an interesting one, and obviously it's part of a new media landscape with the rise in club-specific content. You know, sites like Arsblog, for example, exists for many other clubs, and the way that the media are portrayed and perceived among fans, I think, is a very interesting subject. So with me to talk about that and a lot more, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Daniel Story from Football 365. Hi, Daniel.
Angie, you well?
I am fine, thank you very much. I want to talk to you about something we discussed, myself and James, on the Arscast Extra on Monday, because in the wake of Arsenal's 2-0 win over Tottenham last weekend, there seemed to be more discussion about a tweet that Arsenal sent out, which I'm sure everybody knows about now, but it was a reaction to a journalist who'd written a combined 11, picked 11 Spurs players, and Arsenal sent a cheeky little gif of Mesut Ozil sipping a cup of tea and winking at the camera. You know, all good-natured. Journalists got a bit of a flack, a bit of attention for it, complained about some abuse, which he's absolutely within his rights to do. I just wanted to sort of get your feeling on the whole incident, because it did provoke a really strong response, particularly from certain members of the journalistic profession, who, on the one hand, were accusing Arsenal fans of defending the club at all costs and not countenancing any criticism of the club, but at the same time were perhaps doing the same thing for their own profession.
Yeah, firstly, I think it was probably a mistake on Arsenal's part. I don't think there was any malice intended. I agree that it was a cheeky thing to do. I think if they had their time again, they probably won't do it again, simply because there wasn't an awful lot to be gained out of it, quite frankly. You know, he just won the North London Derby. That was where your happiness lay. There wasn't really a need to win anything else in terms of, you know, little battles. I do think it was non-malicious. I think it was probably a mistake. I also think it was probably a mistake not to add in the you know, the publication themselves as opposed to the individual journalist, because simply because of how Twitter unfortunately works. Arsenal have 12 million followers and it will very quickly be picked up on, and there are people who will use their support and their, you know, the tribalistic support of a football club to excuse their pretty abhorrent views and, yeah, you know, and they're, yeah, basically sounding off. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's a huge crime at all. I think it got blown out of proportion. But I can kind of see why people in the industry kind of got a little bit annoyed at the defense, sort of blind defense of the club. But I don't know. I think that I think the club's intention was certainly honourable.
Sure. I mean, obviously, one of the most enjoyable parts of Football 365 for me, anyway, and I'm sure many of the people listening here, is Media Watch, which it would be fair to say takes a much more critical view of some of the stuff produced by some of the journalists out there than the Arsenal tweet was to that particular journalist. I mean, is there anything wrong with engaging in that kind of, I hesitate to use the word banter, but that kind of engagement, you know, that if people are putting their stuff out in the public domain, then there is the right of everybody to have a little go back. Once I think it is good natured and not you're not instigating or encouraging people to pile on in a malicious way.
Yeah, I suppose I think, to be honest, my biggest blame in all this, although, and it's not really something, it's not football related, is the fault lies with Twitter.
Yeah.
And the fault lies in having a platform whereby people can you know, submit homophobic and anti-Semitic abuse and effectively have no callback, or certainly run a very low risk of having any callback. It would be a shame if that therefore ended the discourse, kind of good-natured banterous discourse between professionals in the industry. That would be a huge shame, because Twitter was intended initially as a way of, you know, it was sold as a kind of get close to your heroes, or get close to the things you love, or find out things about celebrities and clubs, etc.
Yeah.
So it would be a huge shame if that was to be lost. I don't really see a way around it if Twitter is not going to police that any more thoroughly. And I don't really see, you know, I say I don't see Arsenal repeating it. I also don't see other football clubs follow. I think they'll follow their lead and also not repeat that, simply because they won't run that risk anymore, because it's sad, but the minority will unfortunately spoil it for the majority.
Yeah.
Whether there was anything on the publication in question publishing inflammatory, and I use that term, you know, it was a long way away from inflammatory. There is a lot more inflammatory things than have been written about football clubs. Whether it will stop those, you know, the industry doing that, I very much doubt.
Yeah.
I think there is now a need to drive traffic, obviously, to drive clicks, to drive advertising, and therefore we will see more and more inflammatory things being written to drive, whether that's, you know, whether that's what we call clickbait, or whether that's just inflammatory headlines, or whether that's you know, very strong and perhaps slightly ludicrous opinions on things with some of the columnists we see now. We've already seen that in the news side of newspapers, and it was only a matter of time before that grows in the sports side, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you with regards to the platform, because, you know, point I made, and I'm sure it's the same on Football 365, you know, people who want to engage and want to comment on the articles, they have to follow some rules, and the rules are you can't be sexist, you can't be racist, you can't be homophobic, you can't be anti-Semitic, you know, you can't run foul of the rules of the land in terms of libel and all those kind of things. And that is where the issue lies with Twitter, is that people can say these things with impunity and know that their account is not going to be suspended, more likely than not. But I mean, you see it not simply in engagement between, let's say, a football club and a journalist, but you see it when a football club will post something on its own social media channels. You know, I think of for example, if Arsenal post a message to Muslim fans for Eid Mubarak, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, apologies if I'm not, but you will see a litany of responses from Islamophobic people. The same if Arsenal support the Rainbow Laces campaign or mention the gay gooners. Immediately you get a litany of homophobic abuse directed at the Arsenal Twitter account. Now, I don't think the Arsenal Twitter account should stop sending out those messages.
It's the reaction of
those people. So how do we then find the balance? Is there anything that we can do as fans, or do we just kind of have to accept this as part and parcel of online life or using Twitter for as long as Twitter are unwilling to deal with it?
I suspect we have to kind of grin and bear it, unfortunately. I don't suppose that the obvious answer is to go, well, I won't use, I'll take a stand and won't use Twitter anymore. But unfortunately, the our behaviour and our use of it is so entrenched, and it's such a, it's such a staple of the journalism industry as well as football that I don't think we really do have a choice. I think, there are on many more, infinitely more topics than this, there are those who will rail against Twitter's lax policing of its members. And that has long been the case. And this is one of football's most high-profile examples of it. But as you rightly say, every time a football club tweets something that, let's be honest, is not even controversial. This particular topic was quite club specific. It was quite a, you picked all Spurs players, we don't like Spurs, we've got a rivalry. That stoked it up. That was the accusation. But actually, Twitter users and probably the same minority have proven themselves to be completely untrustworthy and completely abhorrent on many different topics. And there are ways of answering, there are ways of engaging with that Arsenal teacup tweet, including the journalists to sort of, there are ways of doing that, to say, got you here, or good joke, or, very mild discourse.
Yeah.
There are ways of doing that without resorting, you'd hope, to offense, effectively hatred, which is what people were doing. And for goodness sake, we kind of, football is meant to be our escape from that kind of thing. It's meant to be the place where we find comfort away from things like that. It's the last place we would like to see that kind of discourse. And as I say, it's a minority spoiling from the majority, but I don't see how the majority can fight this without the help of Twitter. Twitter is the police here.
Yeah, is there something fundamental within football itself that lends itself? I don't mean to the responses to the Arsenal tweets, for example, but when it comes to something like this, you mentioned tribalism, and Arsenal versus Tottenham is obviously a very long-standing, very serious rivalry, and there are positives to that because you look at the atmosphere inside the Emirates Stadium, not known usually for its vociferous. I think it would be fair to say that it can be at times a bit quiet in there. But when Tottenham come to town, because of this rivalry, because of this, for want of a better word, hatred that exists between the two clubs and the two sets of fans, it generates something quite positive. As long as that then doesn't spill over into anything more sinister, into violence, and I don't think anybody would condone that in any way. I mean, there would be people who would condone that, but they're the same people who would send those kind of messages on Twitter. So where how do we find the balance there? Because without those things, it is part of what makes sport so great. It is part of what makes you feel good on a Monday morning when you go back to work and you're working, whether it's a North London derby, the Merseyside derby, Manchester, Glasgow, the El Clasico, whatever it is. Part of what makes winning so great is when you beat that close rival, that person to whom A, you hate, and B, you can't face losing yourself.
Yeah, and obviously there are ways of doing that. I do think there has been a rise of tribalism over the last 4 or 5 years that is associated with certainly with Twitter as a kind of faceless, anonymous medium. It allows people to release their hatred, release their tension without fear of retribution. I think in many ways, English football has done exceptional work over the last 30 years to eradicate or certainly cut down upon things like hooliganism and racism in very explicitly at games. But this, in many ways, this is kind of the new generation of hooliganism. This is, a, you know, the new generation of that kind of football fan hatred. It's not fans, you know, it's not fans on Green Street meeting up and fighting, but it is an equivalent to that because it is, you know, it's unacceptable, it's wrong, and football has a, you know, has to find a solution to it. The big issue now is that this is not a football problem. It's kind of a societal problem, I think. Yeah. I think the rise of tribalism and hatred in general in society, I think, is prevalent as it is in football, and that can't be coincidental.
No.
And, you know, they are much more serious questions with much more difficult answers.
I suppose the other thing that occurs to me when you talk about that is the fact that fans of whatever club now can, I don't mean to organise themselves, but can exist online, and they don't have to exist in anything other than their own bubble, for example. Mm. So Arsenal fans, whether you're Wenger in, whether you're Wenger out, whether you love Olivier Giroud, whether you hate Olivier Giroud, etc., you can find a community within the online sphere because there are just so many of them out there. And the same goes for all the other big clubs, you know, with Liverpool, United, Tottenham, you know, all the clubs have their online presences now. Mm. And in some ways, you know, you see it, you see the division, certainly I see it between Arsenal fans, that even within this bubble, there are divisions, there are, you know, cliques and niches and people who won't have anything to do with anybody else and think these people are assholes. That in some ways, the whole culture, unless it's something that's managed very carefully, these communities can become essentially confrontational, that they exist to be the opposite of something else. That they're there, and the other one is there, and we're gonna butt heads, and that's just what we're gonna do.
Yeah, and I think that is undoubtedly a very modern thing. There's a difference between I would rule a difference between fans and supporters, and I think, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and even in the 90s, a supporter of a football club was someone generally who went to games as and when they could and as and when they could afford it. And they were far easier to manage because if there was any trouble, it was generally either within the ground or within a couple of miles of the ground. And if it was done under the banner of a football club support, the football club and the police could fairly easily get a grip on that. The difference now in when you talk about a club like Manchester United, for example, I think, say, now they have 650 million fans worldwide. Now, clearly, the vast majority of those will never go to Old Trafford and will never go to a Manchester United game. So they have to find a way to almost prove to themselves and prove to other people just how much they love that club. And unfortunately, some people will take that as, I need to show my love by hating everything that is not pro my club. So that's why I think now you get a huge, you know, there's a vast rise in accusations of bias against journalists, which effectively means, you know, I don't like that piece or I don't agree with that opinion or that's against my club. There seems within that community, and it's a huge community, there seems to be a lack of tolerance that you actually, you don't get, you know, you don't get from the match going supporters. So I will speak to a match going supporter, you know, an Arsenal supporter, about Saturday's game, and they will say, yeah, we didn't turn up, yeah, it was bad, it was, you know, it was poor. Sorry, a Tottenham supporter, and they'll say, yeah, it was bad, it was, you know, it wasn't acceptable. I'll write something online about that game, and Tottenham fans will say, well, you're just having a go at our club, you hate our club, you're always having a go at our club.
Yeah,
so there's just there seems to be within that community a lack of tolerance, and I believe it's because they don't go to games generally. They need to find a way to prove their love, to demonstrate their love. And that seems to be, in some cases, being horrible about everything that isn't to do with that.
Sure. I mean, I think another thing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think what's been interesting over the last number of years is that the people that used to be the voice of authority in football coverage were the journalists, the guys who wrote for the big newspapers. They had the back pages, they had the inside pages, they had the sports pages. And there really wasn't anywhere else for people to get their information about their football club. And obviously with the rise of the internet and the advent of, you know, sites like mine and equivalent sites for other football clubs, that the voice of authority has shifted to a certain extent. That people can come to Arseblog and they'll find out more about Arsenal from Arseblog than they will from any newspaper or any journalist. And that's not to say that a journalist writing about Arsenal in his newspaper doesn't know what he's talking about, but it seems to me that the perception of the football, the traditional, if you like, football journalists nowadays has changed. And people feel perhaps freer to have a go at these guys because the knowledge perhaps that they have is not as in-depth as many of the people who read the site. So whatever club you support, you've got all this, you've got this vast knowledge of your club from top to bottom, from on pitch to off the pitch, boardroom, backroom, scouting, who drives the fucking team bus, everything. So the minute there's any kind of perception that the person is inaccurate in any way, it leaves them open to this criticism. And I think you're right that certainly there is there are a cohort of people who will hold no truck whatsoever with any criticism of their football club from anybody. Doesn't matter who it is, they'll defend them right to the hilt. But I think as well, there has been a division between knowledgeable fans and the people who write about football for a living, who we would traditionally have seen as those voices of authority.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think maybe I hope more than expect, but I do hope that the problem lies in the industry more than the individuals. I think it is now, with the rise of online journalism and basically with the, you know, very simply with the industry's failure to spot that it should be charging for that product at the advent of the internet, it has left it in a position where it's now basically playing catch up for revenue because it doesn't charge for the product as standard, which makes it very hard to start charging for it now. Mm. And that's led to a culture where, in some cases, getting clicks is more important than getting the truth. And I honestly think that trust in journalism has probably never been lower, which is a sad thing to say, but I believe that. I don't think the advent of transfer rumor journalism as a concept and as a, you know, almost as an industry within the industry, I don't think that's helped because it leads to cynicism, effect basically across the board, but I also think that the demands of those journalists to not just get the truth and get a good story and get it right, but kind of flower it up to make sure it gets hits, yeah, is a pretty difficult balance for individuals. And the way it's going, it's only going to get tougher to do. And yeah, and you're right, because sites like yours and many others can offer that service at low cost or free, you know, or for free. There has to be something else from journalism now to justify buying the newspaper effectively.
Yeah.
What I hope, and you know, without being too wanky, I would class myself as a writer rather than a journalist because I don't get stories, I comment on them. But I hope that it leads to a raft of better writing because I hope there is still value in good writing, and I hope that people want to read people's take on the stories and enjoy that take just as much as they will enjoy receiving the news.
Sure.
But you're right, you're absolutely right. It is very hard now for a journalist, unless they have impeccable sources, and even if they do, they're kind of accused of just repeating club lines, and yeah, I can see why that happens as well. It's very hard to stand out in the crowd.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you, I think that's a really interesting point you make about being a writer more than a journalist. I mean, is that something you're conscious of when you write? Because, I mean, you know, you're online, you know, you get flack for even the most basic mistake, even something, a typo can lead people to give you a hard time and think, well, you're just a, you know, you're an asshole. And I've got that myself, you know, it was a typo. I'm very sorry. I apologize. They happen. I don't have a team of proofreaders. And sometimes I put stuff out too quickly. I'll hold my hands up. But, you know, you write about, you know, Premier League and beyond, and you write about it from a broad perspective, and kind of where you are is almost in the middle because you're writing for a very big website, but you're still online. You're still sort of straddling those two worlds. Do you feel like there's a demand for, I mean, not that you shouldn't have it anyway, but but a demand for accuracy, that when you are writing something, you need to be absolutely on top of your knowledge. Because, you know, one day, I mean, you do the, what, 16, 17 things we learned about the Premier League this weekend. I mean, that's a lot to take in because, you know, you're writing about Newcastle, then you're writing about Stoke, then you're writing about Arsenal. You know, there is a lot to take in when you're doing that kind of writing.
Yeah, and, you know, I probably write between 50 and 20,000 words a week. So there will be mistakes in it. You know, they generally get published now because of the added issue of time pressure, as well as, you know, as well as demand for content. There's a demand for content half an hour ago. So there is a time pressure. So there will be mistakes and things. To be honest, I have no issue with being pulled up on mistakes. If that helps you to learn from those and move on. And let's be honest, these are not important mistakes in the wider scheme of things. So I have no issue with that, really. I do feel a pressure to write good content, and the way that expresses itself, and it's incredibly narcissistic, is that the rise of social media has led to a kind of neediness within writers, certainly myself, where you kind of constantly wanting feedback. And because some of that feedback will be negative by the very nature of it, you kind of cling on to the positive feedback. It can be a very, you know, without playing the smallest violin too much, it can be quite a lonely industry in that sense, because everyone's kind of doing the same, and everyone knows deep down that, you know, I always joke, it's not a proper job. It's a job that I have to pinch myself, I get to do every day. You know, I don't have any journalism training, so I'm not of that old school at all. I'm just someone that loves football that is lucky enough to be able to write about it. So I think in the great scheme of things, I can't really moan about anything in the industry, because at the end of the day, it's football. It's not, you know, it's not war. And I get me getting to write about it is something I consider myself very lucky for. But the only thing that will annoy people like me is the term lazy journalism. The term biased journalism is a bit of a joke. You know, we hear it all the time, and it's ludicrous. But when you're accused of being lazy, when you work damn hard, that's the only thing that really sticks. And I think people know who work hard. So no, I can't pretend to have any huge gripes about how I'm treated, really.
Sure. I think the, as I said, I referenced it earlier, but I think the Media Watch column does a very good job of referencing much better examples of lazy journalism. And, you know, what I would consider lazy journalism is writing what you think people want to hear rather than what you actually think. Because the number of times you pull up an example of ex-journalist saying this on one day, and within a week he's completely contradicted himself, because that's what happens when you're writing what you think people want to hear rather than what you actually think. Because you can always look back on your opinion and go, well, actually, I thought that then, and now I think this, at least I can explain it. But, you know,
And what the internet age has done is that 20 years ago, no one would ever notice things like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that column is intended to be a kind of sideways glance and a sort of lighthearted look at it. Sometimes it goes beyond that, because sometimes I think the subject matter demands it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The one thing you have to do is write what you think, because if you don't write what you think, then not only are you going to get caught out, but also people are going to kind of lose respect and kudos for your opinion, because they're never going to be sure whether it is actually your opinion or if it's just, you know, it's just what you have been told or what you feel you should write on that day. And I think those people are very quickly found out, and I think those people quite quickly fall away from, you know, away from the mainstream, because they lose their respect. And, you know, and amidst all of that, it should be said that there are some fantastic journalists and some fantastic writers out there who do write what they think, who get good stories, who do great interviews, and I hope that adds some worth to, you know, football fandom as a whole.
No, I agree with you, and I think people are appreciative of those things. You know, I see there are always going to be people who you can't please, and I see great writers and great pieces and great articles and interviews, you know, lambasted by certain fans, and you think, well, what are you looking for here? What is it that you want? You know, this is intelligent, this is well written, and just because it doesn't fit with your worldview doesn't mean that the person who wrote it is, you know, all the things that you say they are. But yeah, no, it's an interesting time. Go on.
The other issue with the industry now is because because of Twitter and because of Facebook and because of this such 24-hour news coverage, and maybe Sky Sports News kind of started it as well, there is a constant demand for content. So therefore, inevitably, that leads to kind of reactionary content post-matches. So, you know, you will say one week Tottenham were brilliant last week, but then they lost to Arsenal and they were awful. And people say, well, last week you said they were good. And the simple answer is, well, yeah, because last week they were good. Because unfortunately now we don't get to make our decisions on sixth monthly basis. Yeah. We have to kind of constantly be offering takes, because takes is content. And that's as frustrating for those writing it as it is reading it, I'm sure.
Yeah, listen, I see, you know, this new thing I've noticed this season is like halftime player ratings. It's like, oh, come on.
Thankfully, I can honestly say I've never done, had to do that.
No, we were gonna do something there the other week, you know, 5-minute player ratings. After 5 minutes of the game, we were going to publish a whole series of player ratings, but I feared that the joke might be lost somewhere along the way.
That's the worry. When the jokes are taken seriously, that's when we have to worry.
All right, look, just very quickly before we go, I want to talk to you a bit about this weekend's game. Arsenal, having beaten Tottenham in the North London Derby, should be in good shape from a confidence point of view to go into a game against Burnley. But what we have, I suppose, in Burnley is a team doing really, really well at this moment in time, level with points in the Premier League with Arsenal. They're a team that's hard to beat, and Arsenal are a team that find it hard to win away from home.
Yeah, and they're a team that Sean Dyche will, even if he gives it the cliche of, you know, just another game, it's the kind of game that he, and therefore by extension his side, will absolutely love to frustrate Wenger and frustrate Wenger's attack. Burnley have defended brilliantly this season. Burnley have been incredibly efficient in attack. They have had far fewer shots on target than their goals for column merits. So if Arsenal defend properly, Arsene Wenger would fancy keeping a clean sheet. And you're right, given the run that Arsenal are on, they can't go into these games fearing same old Arsenal anymore, because it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you go to these grounds and think, well, they're going to make it hard for us and it's going to be horrible and it's going to be cold and so on and so forth, then, as I say, that kind of becomes self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
What the Derby victory does is it should mean that Arsenal are effectively in their highest mood since winning the FA Cup final, and obviously that being the end of last season, so they should be incredibly high spirited, and they should beat Burnley. Burnley have done brilliantly this season, and they have frustrated Chelsea, and they've frustrated Liverpool, and they've frustrated Tottenham. But Arsenal must consider themselves above that. It's another challenge, and it's another way for Wenger to say, again, do you know what? Everyone talks about our mental strength and our mental weaknesses, and rightly so, but here is finally some evidence we're moving in the right direction in exactly the time when people thought we wouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it feels like, you know, Arsenal have got to... They kind of have to go for it. I don't think they can start to really... I'm not saying you should ignore the team you're playing or their record at home or how difficult they are to beat there. But I think what Arsenal have got to do, and it's perhaps one of the things that people criticise Wenger for, is to focus much more on themselves and what they're good at rather than be too cautious when you go into a game like this. I think they've got the attacking strength and the attacking potential plus options from the bench to really have a go. It doesn't mean they've got to be gung-ho. I mean, it's really just look at what you did against Tottenham and do that again.
Exactly. And that to me, as a you know, comparative outsider, that feels quite old Arsenal to me, that going into an away game and effectively treating it as a home game. I remember victories, you know, in the good old days of Wenger against places like Middlesbrough and Everton, where you go and score 4 or 5 goals and effectively just turn up and treat it exactly like a home game. And there seems to me to be a benefit in doing exactly the same this season, because the worry with Arsenal this season was that the home form would be kind of strangled by the mood around the club, which I think it's fair to say at the end of last season did happen. I'm not saying that was a fan's fault at all, because it wasn't, but I think that mood kind of hampered Arsenal slightly. Given the fairly incredible home record this season, there is no reason for fear, because, as I say, if you play every game like you did against Tottenham, you'll finish in the top 4. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. We'll see what Sunday brings for us. Daniel, always interesting talking to you. Thanks a million.
Thanks very much.
Cheers to Daniel. You can find him on Football 365 and on Twitter at DanielStory85. That is at DanielStory85. Right. That's just about that for today's show. I know the midweek result wasn't great, but, you know, I will trade that if we can pick up 3 points against Burnley at Turf Moor on Sunday. It's a difficult place to go. As we know, they're hard to break down. They're hard to beat, but we've got good players who can play well, and they showed that last weekend against Tottenham. It's a different kind of a game, obviously, when you're away from home, and our away record is as iffy as ours has been over the last little while. That adds some doubts to it, but I think we just go for it. I think we've got to pick a team that can score goals. They allow a lot of shots, and if we can be efficient with our chances, I think we can pick up 3 points in this particular game, and from there, perhaps build some momentum. I think there's a midweek game, and then Manchester United, so it's a time of the year where you can pick up a lot of points and you can start to really climb up the table, or if results don't go your way, you can see those ahead of you really stretching out and creating a bit of a gap. So we've got to make sure that we follow up what we did against Spurs with a result on Sunday. So I'm going to keep fingers crossed for that. James and I will be here on Monday. We'll look back at that in the Arsecast Extra. Thank you, as ever, for listening. I really do appreciate it. Remember to share and subscribe and rate and review the podcast if you have time to do that. That would be great. If you don't worry about it. I understand people have busy lives. Catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. I was sitting staring out the window at a dame when the guy walked into the office. I didn't appreciate the interruption. She had legs like a lobster, 10 of them in red as a baboon's asshole. Then I realized I better put the glue down. "What do you want, mister?" I said. "I need help," he said. "Oh yeah," I said, "what kind of help?" "I need information," he said. "I need to find out why everything in my life is so terrible." He gave me all the information, his contact details. I said I'd do some investigating. "Come back in 2 weeks," I said. "All right," he said. 2 weeks passed. I was sitting staring out the window at a... You get the picture. He came back in. "I hope you got good news for me, mister," he said. "I don't know if you call it good news or bad news," I said, "but I know what's going on." "Oh yeah," he said. "Yeah," I said, "there's a reason why everything in your life turns out bad." "Why's that?" he said. "Well, Mr. Hotspur," I said, "it's 'cause you'll always be shit."
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.